strong and can thrive. Learn more at northlandfdn.org. Looking at the weather, we're expecting a lovely day today for this March 25th. Mostly sunny, highs 40 to 46. Northwest winds around 5 miles an hour and overnight lows in the mid-20s. Sounds like a great time for the sap to be running. We'd love to hear from you. Do you have an update from the sugar bush? You can text us 218-326-1234. Coming up later today, we bring you John Latimer's full phenology report. That's at 7:20, and Tornado Bob in for the big weather picture. That's coming up at 8:10. Got a weather question or story? You can text us at 218-326-1234. And then coming up at 9 o'clock today, we bring you one of our newest programs. It is called Headwaters, and today your host is going to be DJ Dang. I'm Heidi Holton. News is next. It's 6:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House National Security Council says it is reviewing an incident. A journalist says he was apparently inadvertently added to a group chat where top administration officials discussed planned U.S. military action. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Atlantic Magazine's editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg somehow got included in a group chat on the messaging app Signal, where the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and others were discussing plans for an attack on Houthi rebels in Yemen. When asked about the story and the breach hours after it came to light, President Trump said it was news to him.
Well, it couldn't have been very effective because the attack was very effective. I can tell you that. I don't know anything about it. You're telling me about it for the first time.
A spokesman for the National Security Council confirms the chat, which broke with longstanding national security protocol, appears to be authentic. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The Trump administration is now invoking state secrets privilege in a case involving deportation flights. NPR's Joel Rose reports a judge is continuing to demand more information about them.
Federal Judge James Boasberg has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from deporting alleged Venezuelan gang members under a rarely used wartime law. And Boasberg is pushing the Trump administration to explain whether it defied his orders when it allowed two deportation flights to continue. But the Justice Department has stonewalled, refusing to answer the judge's questions about the timing and other operational details of the flights. Now, the Justice Department is invoking the state secrets privilege, arguing in a court filing that answering the judge's questions, even under seal, would harm, quote, diplomatic and national security concerns. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, in a related development, a U.S. appeals court panel heard the Trump administration's challenge to Judge Boasberg's order about using the wartime power to deport the migrants. But one appeals court panel judge told administration lawyers, quote, Nazis got better treatment under the wartime power. The Trump administration lawyers sharply refuted that. The wife of Vice President Vance is to visit Greenland this week. Mrs. Vance will be joined by Trump administration officials on a trip that is seen as fraught. President Trump has repeatedly said the U.S. will take over Greenland. The world's largest island is rich in critical minerals. But NPR's Deepa Shivaram says Greenland is a territory of Denmark.
In an interview with a Greenlandic newspaper over the weekend, the prime minister of Greenland said that the visit from members of the Trump administration was very aggressive. He said that Greenland has to face the seriousness of the situation of the U.S. wanting to annex them. Now, Trump, for his part, says this isn't a provocation. He says it's a purely friendly visit and claimed that the U.S. was invited to visit Greenland, though NPR is not able to confirm if there was an invite.
NPR's Deepa Shivaram reporting. You're listening to NPR. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee has a Senate confirmation hearing today. He's President Trump's nominee to be ambassador to Israel. Huckabee is a longtime supporter of Israel and a well-known evangelical Christian. He has spoken favorably of several of Israel's views. One of them includes the potential Israeli annexation of Palestinian territory. That would contradict longstanding U.S. policy and is opposed by other nations. The critically acclaimed hit drama Adolescence is getting more than just views on Netflix. It has sparked a conversation in the UK about the influence of social media on some boys and young men. NPR's Giles Snyder has more.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer told the BBC Monday that the government should not shrug its shoulders at the problem laid bare by adolescents, a four-part series that follows a family in crisis after their teenage son is arrested for killing a female classmate. Starmer said combating misogynistic behavior pushed by some social media influencers is a challenge that must be picked up. He made his first comments about the show and his theme last week, when he was asked about it in Parliament.
This violence carried out by young men, influenced by what they see online, is a real problem. It's abhorrent, and we have to tackle it.
Adolescence is the most watched show on Netflix right now. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
In South Korea, multiple wildfires continue to burn in southern provinces. Cultural buildings are under threat. A Buddhist temple that's more than 1,000 years old has burned down. Treasures inside the temple were relocated in time. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
You're listening to Veterans Voices, the first Gulf War.
My name is Darren Janish, served in the Army for almost 32 years, and started my career as a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne Division and was with them during the first Gulf War. Most of our division participated in Operation Just Cause. We got back from Panama February of 1990. You know, we've been at the division long enough, we'd started doing some math, and we're like, well, you know, the 82nd was involved in some sort of conflict about once every 7 years. Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, Grenada, and then now, well, here's Panama. So we're like, well, that was our thing. And then August 2nd happens, Saddam invades Kuwait. And I walked downstairs, and as I just got down to our CQ desk, the NCO who was on CQ that night had just set the phone down. And the look on his face was like, whoa, because I'd never seen this look on his face. And he just turned to me and he just said, Alpha Alert. And I was like, excuse me, Sergeant? He's like, Alpha Alert, let the boys know. So everybody knew that Alpha meant this is real world, we're going somewhere.
Veterans Voices, the first Gulf War, is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, and is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, Layla will speak with a former CIA analyst about the implications of Trump officials using a commercial messaging app to discuss details of an airstrike in Yemen. But first, the Trump administration is refusing to give a federal judge more information about the way it went about deporting hundreds of Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador. Last night, government lawyers invoked the state secrets privilege to keep Judge James Boasberg from gathering more details about the flights. The judge wanted those details to determine whether officials violated his order to pause the deportations because of a lack of due process. The Justice Department says that that information would, quote, undermine or impede future counterterrorism operations, unquote. To get a better understanding of what's going on here, we called someone who has had key positions at the Justice Department and Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the Obama administration. That is Elliot Williams. He was an assistant director at ICE and a deputy assistant attorney general at DOJ, and he's with us now. Good morning.
Hi, Michelle.
So what is state secrets privilege, and when is it typically invoked?
Certainly. When we think about privileges, they're rules that allow material to be kept out of court. Everyone's heard about attorney-client privilege, where the things you say to your lawyer can't be brought into court, or spousal privilege, conversations you have with your husband or wife or whomever else cannot be brought into court. And state secrets privilege allows the government, when the government is a litigant, to withhold some information from release in court that it has determined relates to national security. Now, to be clear, Michelle, criticism of the state of the use of the state secret privilege has been mounting for decades now. This idea that presidents or presidential administrations are getting quite aggressive and forward-leaning with how much they are asserting the state secret privilege. And to some extent, we're seeing that here.
So did the Obama administration use it? And if so, in what type of cases?
Oh, goodness. I think every administration has at some point. Now, the war on terror, which was prosecuted by both the Obama administration and the Bush administration, you know, they would often invoke such a privilege, and sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. But the fact is, and related to this case here, a presidential administration can't simply wave a wand and say that every word they utter related to national security ought be held out of court. It is up to a judge. Sorry.
Do they have to give the judge a reason why the specific information is covered by that privilege?
Absolutely, and they'll do it outside of public view. They will file sealed affidavits that you and I won't see, but the judge can make the determination as to whether, no, this question could jeopardize U.S. national security, therefore ought not be released in public in court.
So the DOJ lawyers argue that the order, the Trump's in this administration, obviously, argue that the order to pause these deportations is a, quote, unprecedented and enormous intrusion on the powers of the executive branch. And they're saying that the judge doesn't have jurisdiction there. What do you make of that argument?
I don't think it's a particularly great argument for a host of reasons. I think they are basing their decision for removing these individuals on the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, which has really only ever been invoked in wartime. And attempting to make an argument that Venezuelan gang members or alleged Venezuelan gang members in the United States are themselves engaging in an incursion that is tantamount to an act of war. That is a very broad reading of that statute. In so doing, what the administration has done is then been able to hide behind the state secrets privilege and say that, well, we can't talk about why these gang members or alleged gang members are here and what they've done. And so and the judge in this matter is merely attempting to get to the bottom of who are these people? You know, what's your basis for removing them? And what is the evidence you have linking them to acts of the Venezuelan government or acts of international security?
What I think I hear you saying is that this administration is not even willing to make the argument to the judge, even privately. Yeah. Is that accurate? And so what I heard you say earlier is that there are typical disagreements between an administration's efforts to use its authorities as it sees fit and the check provided by the courts. And what I think I hear you saying is that this is out of the bounds of those types of disagreements. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yes, sir. I think that's absolutely accurate. And I think it's perfectly it's healthy for our government, for the executive branch, to be able to assert its authorities in front of a court. But the notion that the court simply has no jurisdiction over them or ought not be able to even review the question is silly. And moreover, the administration's not doing itself any favors by personally attacking the judge repeatedly and the integrity of the court. So there's a bigger, broader question of public faith and institutions here that the administration's at the heart of. But the core question of does a judge even have the authority to weigh the question is an important one.
Before we let you go, is this case likely headed to the Supreme Court?
I think it is. Whoever loses this appeal, there was an appeal that went to the appeals court here in Washington, D.C. just yesterday. Whoever loses that on a very technical question that came up yesterday is going to appeal this to the Supreme Court. And they have an interest in taking it simply because of the importance of these national security and constitutional questions.
That's Elliot Williams. He is a CNN legal analyst and former assistant director for legislative affairs at U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE, under the Obama administration. Thanks so much for joining us.
Always great to talk to you, Michelle. Take care.
The White House is confirming a stunning security breach. A journalist was included, apparently by accident, in a group text where top U.S. officials were making war plans on the messaging app Signal. Here's how The Atlantic's editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg explained it on All Things Considered yesterday.
I'm included in a group chat called Houthi PC Small Group. PC in White House parlance stands for Principals Committee. And I look at the group, it's 18 people or so, and it includes what I take to be the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Vice President, CIA Director, and so on.
Goldberg says he was skeptical at first, but quickly learned it was, in fact, a space where administration officials were trading detailed texts about weapons and tactics for strikes on Houthi rebels in Yemen. To discuss how extraordinary a breach like this is, we're joined by Ned Price. He was a State Department spokesperson under President Joe Biden and spent more than a decade at the CIA before that. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Lila.
So, Ned, you spent more than a decade at the CIA, then time at the State Department, where most recently you were deputy UN ambassador and sat on the Principals Committee, which makes policy decisions on U.S. national security matters. So with that hat on, what was your reaction to hearing top cabinet officials, including the vice president, the secretary of state, the secretary of defense, were discussing war plans on a private messaging app?
You know, Leila, look, I've been dismayed on a number of policy fronts by this administration. That is to say, what I think are the dangerous, reckless decisions that they're making, again, on a policy basis. But it's fair to say that never in my wildest dreams could I have imagined that they'd be this reckless and careless with our national security in terms of how they were going about doing that. In other words, the technical aspect of how they get to these decisions. Over the course of the past 24 hours or so, I've been talking to former colleagues who also sat in on these principal committee meetings. And it's fair to say, Leila, that heads are exploding because, as Jeffrey Goldberg just alluded to, the Principals Committee, it's really the apex of the national security decision-making process. It's where the toughest, most consequential decisions are made. And to see it done in this manner, it is nothing that I think any of us ever could have expected.
How is this information supposed to be shared between government officials who might be traveling and unable to meet in person?
Well, Leila, almost by definition, the principals, the meetings of the Principals Committee are held in the White House Situation Room, perhaps the most secure venue within the U.S. government. And those who are able to be there in person are there in person, literally sitting around the table. But when you're a national security principal, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, often you're called to travel overseas, naturally. Those who can't be there in person are able to join by what's called CIVITS, or Secure Video Teleconference. This is a top secret network that beams them into the White House Situation Room. And whenever a cabinet member within the national security realm travels overseas, he or she has a team that goes before them. They will set up a secure tent, they will set up the camera, so that these individuals are able to join on a secure basis. And not just a secure basis, but a top secret encrypted basis. Even if that fails, Leila, there are fallbacks. And those fallbacks are to join by voice, to join by a top secret, basically a top secret phone that, while you can't see the principal on camera, you can at least hear their voice. Applications like Signal, unclassified cell phones, that, on the other hand, is not something that it would certainly be appropriate for these discussions.
Now, there have been concerns around breaches in the past. For example, Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State under Barack Obama, communicating on a private email server. How unprecedented is this breach?
Well, to my mind, there is no precedent. And, you know, you raised the Hillary Clinton case. I think the difference there is that, and there are many of them, I wouldn't even compare the two in some respects, but the key difference is that the Secretary Clinton and her team knew that they were communicating on an unclassified system. And they went to links to ensure that, to the best of their ability at the time, to ensure that what they were saying was on an unclassified basis. To my mind, this is very, very different because these individuals, while they knew they were on Signal, a commercial software, on what I suspect were their personal cell phones, not even their government-issued cell phones, they knew they were on this unclassified system, and yet it seems that they were discussing some of the most sensitive elements within the national security realm, information that is so dangerous because it went beyond Yemen. The way Jeffrey Goldberg describes it, he alludes to what we refer to as sources and methods. That is to say, the tactics that the intelligence community and the Defense Department would use against any set of challenges we have, whether it's the Houthis, whether it's a state actor or a non-state actor.
Former State Department spokesman Ned Price, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's 6:19. You're listening to Morning Edition here on Independent KAXE, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Coming up about 6:30, we bring you national Native news. We'll also bring you some student phonology reports from around the state of Minnesota. We want you to weigh in today as spring is blooming. What are you looking forward to as the seasons change? Text us at 218-326-1234. We receive support from Beltrami Electric. Building an all-of-the-above energy strategy that combines the diverse strengths of sun, wind, coal, and water. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. And thanks also goes out to Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Looking at the weather around the region, we are expecting mostly sunny skies with highs 40 to 46, northwest winds around 5, and overnight lows in the mid-20s. Later today, we bring you On the River. DJ Ironsides is our host at 1 o'clock, and tonight at 7 o'clock, it is Sarah. But more news is coming up next from National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Look for local news at our website, KAXE.org.
From the station. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach, starts Friday in theaters. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Beijing. When you travel in China, as our team has been doing, you meet a fair number of people who know English. Millions of Chinese citizens have been educated in the United States. They include the top executives of companies, economists, government officials. The president's daughter attended Harvard University. The flow in the other direction is much smaller, but there is some, even in this time of rising tensions between the world's two largest economies. So what is it like for Americans who learn the language of a trading partner and rival? NPR's Emily Fang visited an American elementary school that teaches it.
It's Monday morning at the Yuying Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. I hear Mandarin Chinese floating through the hallways of this 700-person school.
Do you want to speak in English or Chinese?
Lucas Wahib is a 10-year-old student here, and he really wants to speak in Chinese.
你喜欢学中文吗?
Why do you like learning Chinese, I ask him.
很喜欢,因为很难.
I like learning Chinese very much because it's hard, Wahib says.
我也可以...
And he says he and his brother speak in Mandarin with each other, so their parents can't understand them. The whole idea here in Yuying's classrooms is to immerse kids from the age of 3 in both English and Chinese. The school's principal, Carly Fischero, says most students, including her own kids who attend the school, do not have Chinese ancestry, but
they know the importance of being bilingual or multilingual in an increasingly interconnected global world.
Yuying was founded in 2008, right around the time U.S. interest in Chinese was peaking. Beijing was hosting its first ever Olympics, the Summer Games, to great fanfare.
There was a strong global push to increase the number of Asian languages that U.S. students were learning.
And the following year, then-President Barack Obama announced the 100,000 Strong Initiative to get more American students traveling to China. In 2011, those numbers peaked at 15,000 students. But that's all changed. Just a decade after, during the COVID pandemic, that number fell to just 200 American students. It's now still less than 1,000 every semester. Yuying stays away from discussing geopolitics, but sometimes U.S.-China tensions creep in. Fisherow says this year her daughter, who studies Mandarin, heard on the news that the U.S. Postal Service was considering banning inbound packages from China.
And she screamed from the back of the car and was like, "No packages from China! That's where we get our curriculum! Are you kidding me? We get our books from China, and we get everything from China!" And I was like, "Yep." She was like, "That's not right."
American universities like the University of Oregon and the University of Washington are reducing Mandarin classes. At Yuying, though, enrollment is increasing. So much so, they just built a second campus.
My Chinese name is Suka.
This is another student here named Francesca Lucia Sousa, almost 11 years old.
Su is for Sousa, and then Ka is for Ka'ai, and Ka'ai in Chinese means cute, so I'm Sousa Cute.
Language empowers her to connect to more people, she says, including Chinese people.
Like, we come up to them, and then we're just like, "Hey, we speak Chinese, want to talk?" And then they talk to us about, like, where they're from.
And for her, learning Mandarin Chinese is not about the U.S. versus China. It's a tool for thinking creatively and traveling far, and for Sousa, dreaming big. She hopes to work as an interpreter at the United Nations one day. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
The genetic testing company 23andMe is filing for bankruptcy. Customers spit in a tube and send it to the company for DNA analysis to learn about their health or family history. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports there are privacy concerns about what could happen to all that data.
23andMe said over the weekend that it's entering bankruptcy proceedings in the hope of finding a buyer. The announcement comes just a few months after the California company laid off roughly 40% of its staff. Now, the big question is who that buyer will be and what they will do with the sensitive information of over 15 million 23andMe users. Suzanne Bernstein is counsel at the nonprofit Electronic Privacy Information Center.
The scale of how much highly sensitive data that 23andMe has is unique.
Several states have passed their own genetic privacy laws, but legal experts say federal law has little to say on the subject. And some laws, such as HIPAA, don't apply to direct-to-consumer companies like 23andMe. Here's Anya Prince, a University of Iowa law professor who studies health privacy.
It's really hard to control what happens to your information when it's outside the healthcare space.
She says 23andMe customers worried about a potential sale should consider asking the company to delete their genetic data. 23andMe suffered a major data breach 2 years ago, which impacted nearly 7 million customer accounts. In an open letter to customers on its website, the company now says it's looking for a buyer who, quote, shares in its commitment to customer data privacy. Prince says that while there are open questions about what a potential buyer would do, 23andMe already shares anonymized data, including with pharmaceutical companies.
Everybody's worried about what a new company can do with the data, and that is a concern. But frankly, some of the things that people are worried about, 23andMe already can do or already does.
The company says it'll remain in operation through the bankruptcy proceedings and that customers can still delete their data and shutter their accounts. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we look at the history of the wild festival that helped define the 90s, Lollapalooza. Ask your smart speaker for your local station, hear it on the radio or in the NPR app. This is NPR News.
The threat of a massive earthquake hangs over the Pacific Northwest, and no one knows when it could strike. For instance, you could be massively pregnant and crib shopping at IKEA.
I wrote this book because I was starting to crack
living with the fear of this.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The debut novel, Tilt, by author Emma Patti, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered. It's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE with your local host, Jennifer Barr. It's 6:29. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. We're expecting partly sunny skies today with highs 40 to 48 and mostly cloudy in the evening tonight, 20 to 26. Partly sunny tomorrow, 44 to 51. West winds 5 to 15. And overnight lows in the upper 20s to low 30s. So the next 3 days looking about the same with temperatures mid 40s to low 50s. And then overnight in the mid 20s to low 30s. That sounds like spring.
Sounds like spring to me. Sounds like sap gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And how's it been going?
It shut down for a little bit, but we gathered a lot already, and then we're hoping there was a little bit yesterday, not quite enough to empty yet. So I'm hoping for more today. We think it'll be a good week.
All right. Well, there's a sign of spring, and yeah. I understand our question of the week is about signs of spring.
You know something about that.
I do. I have I have a few records of springtime events over the years.
Oh, like how many, John Latimer?
Well, let's see. It says I have... Oh, look, 55,535.
Oh, wow.
As of last night.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a lot of data.
Yeah.
Somebody ought to come and sort that out.
That's what we rely on you to do each and every Tuesday.
Oh, yeah.
Between John and our student phenologists, we get a clear picture of what's happening throughout the entire state of Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, if you have a sign of spring in your neighborhood, we'd like to hear from you. Text us this morning and let us know what it is.
218-326-1234. Coming up, we're going to be hearing from National Native News. New Mexico is joining three other states that have now created an alert system for missing Indigenous people. Stay tuned for that story. And we are still, so today's March 25th, until March 28th, we are still accepting your gently loved vinyl donations, getting ready for our annual Record Store Day sale. It's Saturday, April 12th from 9 to 1 at the Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. You can dig through the crates with us and find new old gems for your collections.
My kids both have turntables. I think one of them
took all your records, didn't they?
They took my records. I think one of them has my turntable. yeah, and what I'm left with are cassette tapes.
Oh boy, yeah.
I have boxes of cassette tapes.
I do too. I have a whole bunch of cassette tapes here. I think of your early shows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you could just find the one for this date and shove it in there. I'm sure it's not much different.
I think it probably is.
The voice probably sounds a little younger. Yeah, not so cracked and screechy.
Coming up in this half hour, we're going to bring you the first part of our student phenology reports. So stay tuned.
Yeah, we've got some interesting reports coming up. I've been looking through them and want to... wish a good morning and welcome to Nate Masakovich and his fourth graders at Baxter. And they have they've been really consistent every spring for the past 4 or 5 years, maybe longer. They have come along and volunteered their observations. They have a nice little hike there that they go on, and the kids are really, really well-schooled, so it's going to be fun to listen to that, as well as others that will be coming your way in the next, well, throughout the morning. We're going to have some coming up another 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll have some before the 8 o'clock hour, and hopefully we'll have a few left over to run to you just before the 9 o'clock hour.
And then it's Headwaters with your host, DJ Dang.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill to create an alert system for missing Indigenous people in New Mexico has passed the state legislature and heads to the governor's desk. Jeanette Didios has more.
The turquoise alert system will allow law enforcement to quickly share information about missing Indigenous people through news media, social networks, and digital highway signs without having to wait the standard 48 hours. According to the New Mexico Department of Justice, there are about 200 missing Indigenous people in the state. Bill sponsor, Democratic Senator Angel Charlie, who's Laguna and Diné, shared the news on Instagram and said the system is not a tribal mandate, but will instead go through the Department of Public Safety.
It's not going to fix our jurisdictional complexity issues, but it is going to ensure that when a Native person goes missing, that there's immediate rapid response.
The alert system will coordinate with state law enforcement agencies, tribal communities, and state resources when a missing Indigenous person goes missing. The governor has 20 days after the session ends to sign this bill into law and would take effect July 1st. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
The number of Alaska Native language speakers has been declining over the years, including speakers of Aleutic. But a new language class that's live streamed from Port Lions aims to combat that trend locally. KMXT's Davis Hovey reports.
Jamai, Kuyana Teluji, hello and welcome. Thank you all for coming to another episode of King's Corner.
Every Thursday, students from the school in the native village of Port Lions discuss Aleutic culture and language. That's in preparation for class lessons and conversations in Aleutic that are live streamed online twice a month. It's the Port Lions students' first time speaking their native language within school through the Aleutic Culture class. That includes practicing everything from weather reports to animals and place names in Aleutic. Jess Egemeyer II, who works for the native village of Port Lions, teaches the class.
I really saw a need for content that was focused on the local community and that would include current events happening in the village and at the school, a local safety bulletin, you know, the weather forecast, as you've seen.
Egemeyer says the live stream, which is called King's Corner after the school's mascot, is a product of elders and the previous generation laying the groundwork for language revitalization in Port Lions and around Kodiak Island. That multi-year-long effort by multiple organizations and individuals has led to Aleutic textbooks, digital audio recordings of Native speakers, and language courses for college students or even adults.
If we don't teach our children now, this is how languages die, and it's unfortunately not uncommon.
Alaska Native languages in general are at risk of being lost or going extinct as elders who speak the language are passing on. For Koniag or Kodiak Aleutic, which is the dialect mainly spoken in the Kodiak archipelago, less than 20 fluent first language speakers are still alive today. Egemeyer says the class will go through the rest of this semester and he hopes to continue it this summer and next school year too.
We say in Aleutic, Tunk Chikungin Chali, I will see you again.
Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Havi.
The U.S. Postal Service is hosting a first day of issue ceremony for its Forever Stamps, celebrating powwows. Four stamps showcase paintings of Native dancers by Cochiti Pueblo artist Mateo Romero, featuring women's traditional dance, crow hop dance, men's hoop dance, and women's fancy shawl dance. The ceremony will be held at the Gathering of Nations powwow in April in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You hear it here weekday mornings and afternoons on KAXC. Thanks so much for tuning in today.
Yeah, indeed. We remind you that support for the programs comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org.
We're going to be talking nature and signs of spring, as you do at this time of year. But first, I think we're going to take a listen to our album of the week. It's by Charlie Crockett. It's called Lonesome Drifter. Doesn't he look like a lonesome drifter?
He does. He does. He pretty wild shirt for a drifter, actually. But
yeah, that's true. He is a musician from Texas. This is his 15th album in 9 years, and it's produced by Shooter Jennings. I think it's Mason. No,
I'm getting that wrong. Shooter Jennings is the producer of it. I'm getting things mixed up. He channels kind of a 70s Nashville country music vibe with one foot set in 2025. We're going to take a listen now to the song called One Trick Pony. This is Charlie Crockett, our album of the week.
I never saw a town where I threw them races down. Didn't know the lonesome sound of a midnight train. The kind that calls my name, I was born to play the game. Even if it's all in vain, call me what you want. I'm bound to tell the truth the way that gamblers rarely do. They'd be tying up your noose and calling you friend. If it was up to me, like the blue butter, you'd be free. Though his life ain't what it seems if you catch my drift. Men pretend to be poor, poor folks only want a little bit more. What they never had before, and it's a crying shame. My daddy worked the land, and mama raised me with a hand. We all do the best we can with the cards we're dealt. I ain't one big old plea, but I could show you some relief. Those who label me up tall. And there's a woman on my mind. For her I'd glad to give my life. And the little girl by her side that wears my name. A one trick pony knows that it's all about the show. Life is but a rodeo, and you can write that down. I best be moving on. You turn your head and I'll be gone. In this world I won't be long, just like you.
That is Charlie Crockett. The album is our album of the week, Lonesome Drifter, and I was stumbling around, but I checked it out. It is produced by Shooter Jennings, who is the son of Waylon Jennings.
Oh, okay.
And this is Charlie Crockett's 15th album in 9 years. So we want to know what you think. It's got quite a sound that sounds like, as it was described, kind of from the past, but also sort of new. Mm-hmm. There's something about it. Let us know what you think. You can text 218-326-1234. We heard from Mary from Cass Lake. She says, good morning, Heidi. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mary.
Yeah, good to hear from you.
And did Mary have a sign of spring to share?
She hasn't yet.
I'll bet she has one that she just forgot.
Right. I bet you sometimes we get the sunset photos from her.
Oh, okay.
Driving, which I enjoy.
Yeah. So. Yeah, there have been some spectacular sunsets. Now it's getting hard for me to stay up that late. But
yeah.
Actually, I don't mind. I miss the early morning light.
Yeah, I do too.
But That's because I'm generally up early in the morning, but that's okay.
Looking at the temperatures around the region, it looks like we are at 21 in Hibbing, 23 in Bemidji, 20 in Aiken, 22 in Brainerd, 25 in Grand Rapids. Looks like Bagley's reporting 22, Floodwood at 21, and Manoman 22 this morning.
It's cool around the area. It's good, I guess. If the weather holds, that is, if we get into the 40s today and we go into the 20s again tonight, that sounds like good sap running temperatures. I've been talking to a bunch of people who are doing maple sapping, syruping, sugar bush, who have gone to the sugar bush. And there is a pretty solid basis for confidence. It seems like the number of people that I have talked to have told me that there is a pretty good run and has been, and they are experiencing some decent sap gathering, and hopefully they'll be able to boil it all out and there'll be syrup aplenty. Yeah. It'll be time to make pancakes again.
Oh my gosh. Is there ever a time to not make pancakes?
I can't think of it. They're sort of a universal, I'll have pancakes for supper.
I know.
If somebody is serving pancakes,
that's one of my,
okay with me.
It took me a long time as an adult to realize my mother convincing us that the most amazing thing was going to happen that night, which was breakfast for dinner. Was probably because we didn't have anything else in the house.
There was always that.
But she totally convinced me that it's like, what? Breakfast for dinner? My gosh.
So. Yeah. At our house, it was my mother would make cornmeal porridge.
Oh.
But she wouldn't serve it. She would put it in a bread pan and put it in the freezer and freeze it. And then at night, she would cut it into slices and fry it.
Oh, wow.
And so we would have fried, we called it fried cornmeal mush. I think nowadays they call it polenta. But it was, you know, one of those, like, I'm sure, as you said, it was probably at the end of the 2 week pay period. And it was probably like, this is what we have, so enjoy. But, you know, you were never made to feel like that.
No.
You just kind of sat down and you were pretty excited to have something different for supper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
good times.
I think our first syrup of the year, we'll do that for, you know, the evening meal, I think.
Just pancakes?
To celebrate, yep.
All right. Well,
there we go.
Goes well on polenta, too. Just saying. I put it on my oatmeal in the morning, so that's just kind of how I roll.
It's good, isn't it?
Pour a little dash of maple syrup on your oatmeal and enjoy that mush.
I made a big batch of granola yesterday with maple granola.
Ooh.
Making it in the crock pot. You just cook it slow kind of all day, warm it, and then put it out on pan so it crisps up, and then lock it away, and just like every nut you can think of, and put some chocolate chips in there too. Cause
why not?
Someone in my house loves the chocolate chips in there.
It's, you know, it's a reason to get up in the morning. I buy the trail mix with the little, with nuts and craisins and raisins and little chunks of chocolate, and I pour that onto my oatmeal.
Mm-hmm.
Put a handful of that in my oatmeal in the morning. So, yeah.
That's the benefit on Mondays. I often get to work from home and catch up on things and do meetings, and I can do something in the background. I can make the granola slowly, so kind of nice. But I bet we need to move from food to nature.
We do, in fact, and it is time to talk about some signs of spring. And we have had, we have school children out all over the state checking out for signs of spring, and they are coming. So without further ado, let us tell you that funding for student phenology is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Phenology talkbacks are produced by Charlie Mitchell. And our first report comes from the Phenology Club at Oak Grove Elementary School in Bloomington.
Hi, this is Dixie,
Kylie,
and Camila,
reporting from Oak Grove Elementary in Bloomington, Minnesota.
We are having colder, windier weather. Tomorrow, we might have a big snow coming. Today, we tapped our maple tree. We drilled a hole in the tree pointing upwards, put a tapper in it, and then have a tube feeding in the container.
Later, we are going to get some sap out of it. We have to boil the sap for 7 to 8 hours to get syrup. Then we are going to taste test it against store syrup.
We looked at our three cut tree branches to study their growth. We noticed the red maple, buckthorn, and river birch are not green anymore on the inside. They are turning brown. We think that means they are starting to die.
That's all for today. Stay tuned for the next OGE Phenology Club Nature episode.
Keep one eye open on nature.
Indeed. Keep one eye open on nature for sure. Heck, if you're not driving, keep them both open. Dixie, Kylie, and Camila, thank you. What a nice report. They've gathered some sap. They are gathering sap, and they're going to boil it and make syrup, and then they're going to taste it against some store syrup. I can guarantee you how that one's going to turn out. The one kid in the class who says he likes store syrup better is probably going to get drummed right out of the classroom. Looking at their three cut branches where they cut the branches and wanted to study the growth, they're not green anymore. And the reason for that is the branch only is part of the story. The branch holds some energy in it. It has some sugars, some power, some chemistry to help develop the flower or the leaf, but there is only a limited amount in the branch. And when the branch is connected to the tree and this whole process begins, well, then the tree contributes from the roots. But when you just cut a branch off of a tree like that, you only have what is ever stored in the branch, and it isn't enough for the branch to carry on and continue to grow. Although, if you pick a willow, you may see some roots develop. Willows typically can quite readily root from a branch. So just so you know, you don't have to throw them all out, but probably your maple, your buckthorn, and your birch are going to go out the door. Our next report comes from Chad Caddett's class at Little Falls Middle School.
This is Brecken
and Eason reporting from Mr. Caddett's class in Little Falls Middle School. This is our phenology report of the week of March 23rd. We saw our first earthworm of the year on the sidewalk by our school on the 18th.
The aspen catkins are very large, and they look like a fuzzy gray caterpillar on the branches. Our first fox sparrow arrived on the 19th, and our first turkey vultures were spotted on the 20th.
The cold temperatures at night have provided us with the perfect conditions to form maple sapsicles.
The male red-winged blackbirds have returned and are competing for ideal locations in the cattails for when the females come back later this month.
We had a black bear sighting, so they are out of their sleep and will be searching for food. Bald-faced hornet hive still standing.
The first crocuses were blooming in our gardens.
We have seen the return of the sandhill cranes, and they are spotted out in the fields in pairs.
There was a pair of pileated woodpeckers on the same tree, so we were thinking it may be a mating pair.
The first standing line leaves were spotted by our school on the 20th.
We have also seen the return of grackles and larger flocks of robins.
There have been wild turkeys that are starting their displays.
This is our phenology report for this week. Until next week, keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
Thank you, Easton and Brecken. Nice report. They really have quite the system there. I mean, they're talking about earthworms, aspen catkins. Our aspen catkins, I looked yesterday, half an inch, maybe 3/4 of an inch. They will, by the time they're done expanding, be like 3 inches. So, and they are they are looking at Aspen catkins coming along pretty well there in the Little Falls area. Fox sparrows, those are kind of a big sparrow with lots of red, red tail, red back, red in the sense of a horse red, sort of a chestnut red, not red like a cardinal or a purple finch, but nonetheless in that spectrum. And you'll notice them when they show up. They'll be on the ground raking through the leaves in your yard looking for seeds. So be alert for the fox sparrows. Turkey vultures, I haven't seen them yet here, but if they were spotted down there on the 20th, they should be here probably later this week, maybe before we talk again next week. The maple sapsicles. We had some sapsicles last week with some of the kids at East Elementary School, and though they were a little reluctant at first, once they got a taste of them, they were, that was it. And the sapsicles all disappeared. The kids went around that tree and found every little branch that had a wound and found every little icicle that had some sugar, and they really went after them. Black bear sightings, they get up and start moving about, but they aren't really very hungry right away. Oddly enough, they'll wander about for a while before they really begin to get hungry. But once they do, you're going to want to be watching your bird feeder and maybe taking it in at night, or at least cleaning it off so that they aren't attracted to it in a way that can be damaging to your bird feeders. First crocuses blooming. That's pretty cool. I haven't seen anything like that around here, but I'm sure that somebody out there has probably got a crocus that's up and maybe in the process of putting out a flower. Sandhill cranes. I heard my first sandhill cranes last Friday or Saturday. I can't recall, but very soon they will be familiar and loud in the area. Pileated woodpeckers, a pair working in the same tree. Probably are a mated pair. First dandelion leaves, grackles, and larger flocks of robins. I've seen a few robins around. I haven't seen one at my house, and I haven't seen one here at KAXE, but the city of Cohasset is loaded with them. We were out last Thursday walking around, and we must have seen five or six of them. The wild turkeys are definitely dancing. The males are displaying for the females. I have that going on at my house as well. So lots of things out there to look for. And among them are probably all of the things that those kids mentioned. If they're not here yet, they will be soon. Our question of the week is, what signs of spring are you seeing? So if you have a sign of spring, why don't you text it along to us? We'd like to hear from you. It's sort of what I've been doing for the last 41 years or so. Get in touch with us. Let us know what's happening in your neighborhood, because that's what makes phenology kind of cool. It's always different in everybody's yard. As I said, I have a number of sightings of robins, all in the city of Cohasset, none at my home, but that's just how phenology works. So send us your observations, 218-326-1234, and you can text us what's happening at your house. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org.
Coming up, we've got local news with the Up North Report. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. With ice conditions changing rapidly, the Minnesota DNR is reminding us to use extreme caution on area lakes. When fluctuating temperatures and rain with those, ice can deteriorate quickly. Ask others about the conditions, wear a life jacket, use ice picks, and if you do go ice fishing, bring a buddy.
I was out at the lake yesterday, and the water is remarkably low, lower than I can ever recall it. And the ice, I didn't even try. I just let the dog go out. Wander around. I thought, why would I want wet feet? I got more places to go and more things to do, and wandering around in the yard and in the woods with wet boots is never any fun. So I stayed off the ice myself, and that from a guy who's pretty fond of ice, actually. Yeah. I use ice for a lot of fun things.
Still a lot of people out there. I'm hearing a lot of four-wheelers. Luckily, hopefully no one is driving trucks or cars out there. This is not the time to be doing that.
This would be a bad time of year to do that because there are going to be some spots where the ice is not going to hold.
Yeah.
And if you think your day is going along swimmingly, why put a truck in the water and then see how much fun you're having.
Mm. We're expecting for the day today, partly sunny skies, highs 40 to 48 with mostly cloudy skies this evening. 20.